Well, hello and welcome to Palestine Deep Dive, where today we're joined by Chris Gunness. And Chris, of course, a familiar face in the UK, but also around the world as a former chief spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency of the occupied Palestinian territories. Of course, as Chris would tell you, UNRWA's remit stretches far wider than that. And Chris is also the director of the Myanmar Accountability Project. But he's with us today, and we're delighted to have you, Chris. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
I just wonder, given that Lisa Nandy, the British opposition international trade and development minister, is in Washington today and has called for funding to be restored to UNRWA, do you have a message for the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, for the Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, and for the leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, in this country?
Rishi Sunak, Lord Cameron, Keir Starmer, you must immediately restore British funding to UNRWA, because what the agency is now facing is a financial crisis and a political crisis, which is an existential crisis ultimately, because what Israel is trying to do is shut UNRWA down in the West Bank and Gaza. And you restoring funding to UNRWA would send a very powerful signal of both political and financial support to an agency which, by the way, you dealt a death blow in defunding UNRWA. You took away, although you claim it was not going to be paid quickly and therefore it wasn't really, but you sent a very powerful signal to the other 15 donors who took away their funding from UNRWA that Britain was withdrawing funding for political reasons, and that was a big mistake. So we resume the funding immediately, because 1.2 million people before the fighting in October were on UNRWA's food distribution list in Gaza. Because of the action you took, all of that is in doubt. So can you please restore funding immediately? And beyond that, can you please put your name and your weight and your political weight, as it were, behind accountability? Because what we're really lacking as far as UNRWA is concerned is, for example, an independent, comprehensive, transparent investigation into the 178 UNRWA staff members who have been killed. When the World Central Kitchen staff were killed, you took a phone call, you talked, Rishi Sunak, at least you talked to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who said there'd be an independent investigation. We have to make sure that there's an independent investigation, not just the UNRWA staff members who've been killed, 178, but all of the people, all of the 32,000 plus and rising people who were killed in Gaza. Those are two simple steps you can take. And there's a lot more on my list, by the way.
Thank you, Chris. Well, I mean, we have 2 million people displaced in Gaza. We have over 33,000 civilians killed, mainly women and children. We have these 75,000 people injured, many with life-changing injuries. And we have the Commissioner General of the organization used to be a spokesperson for in New York, telling the United Nations, in his words, that there's an insidious campaign by Israel. An insidious campaign by Israel, which is denying life-saving aid to Gaza. Now, that's an incredibly powerful claim and borne out by facts on the ground. Now, of course, what we've heard, Chris, as you know, is repeated commitments and promises from the Biden administration and from the UK government and from the EU, saying to the Israelis, you must allow in humanitarian aid. And yet we see from what the Commissioner General is saying is actually is still being blocked. And as part of, as he says, this insidious campaign to drive UNRWA out as an organization.
Yes, I mean, it's an insidious campaign based on a lie. Let's make that clear. So on the 27th of January, the day after the International Court of Justice ruled that there was a plausible genocide taking place in Gaza, Israel released to journalists, and of course only the New York Times would put it on its front page, claims, and I use the word claims advisedly, that 12 UNRWA staff members had taken part in the 7th of October attack. Since then, that was 6 months ago, the Israelis have produced absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever. It remains just as a status of claim. So yes, there's a campaign going on. B, it's based on a bunch of lies. Now, to be clear on this campaign, what the Israelis are doing is both an operational campaign and a political campaign, and with a financial aspect too. So the political campaign consists of them smearing UNRWA and deliberately putting out lies, like the allegations, the claims, I should call them, of the 12 staff members. And this, of course, has been taken up by Israel's friends around the world, including the British government, of course, and used it as a pretext for defunding. And then there's a big smear campaign that UNRWA staff members are inherently anti-Semitic, that they have taken part in these attacks. But actually, if you look at the fact that there are 13,000 staff members of UNRWA, even if it's true that 12 staff members did take part, and let's be clear, the context of this is a blockade, a brutal blockade that's gone on since 2007, and you know, killings with impunity of women and children, disabled people across the Gaza Strip. So there was a context to those attacks. Not that I'm justifying this in any way. All I'm saying is that, you know, the Israeli narrative is that this was a surprise attack that came out of nothing. Mm. It's not a complete nonsense, another part of the tissue of lies upon which this political attack on UNRWA is based. So there's also an operational aspect, which means that in Gaza, UNRWA has not been allowed to do convoys into northern Gaza since the 22nd of March. And there are 300,000 people or thereabouts in northern Gaza who are literally starving. So as a direct result of Israel's operational campaign attack on UNRWA, 300,000 people are actually starving as we speak. Now, in the West Bank, the operational attack is more insidious in a way because it's less visible. It's not in the news so much. It is a bit, but it's less visible in terms of you know, being able to see. So there are three things going on. One is that the lease on UNRWA's huge headquarters in the West Bank is now being questioned. So it's not just UNRWA's headquarters, it's also the headquarters of UNRWA's West Bank operation. And that would deal a serious blow to UNRWA if that was shut down. There's also a campaign to stop UNRWA staff and other members of the UN get visas. So visas are being issued on shorter and shorter term. They're being delayed. So when people pick them up, they only in any case have a few weeks left. So the visa campaign is something which is extremely concerning. And then there's the campaign to stop UNRWA using Israeli banks. So it's not well known, but in order to procure aid provisions for the West Bank, flour, mattresses, medicines, you know, all sorts of things, UNRWA has to use Israeli banks. And without that, it becomes impossible or very difficult for UNRWA to procure humanitarian goods. So, you know, it's you can't point a camera at a bank account, and you can't point a camera at a lease on a building, and you can't point a camera at a visa. But, you know, that is what is going on. And it has severe implications for UNRWA. Of course, as we saw when the Americans said to the Israelis, get aid into Gaza, suddenly, you know, they got aid into Gaza, that this bureaucratic attack on UNRWA would cease tomorrow morning if the Israelis said, you're not going to get $3.8 billion worth of military aid every year unless you allow UNRWA to operate. So, you know, that's what could happen to solve this operational attack.
I'm interested in you telling us all of this, Chris, because much of it is news to me, and I've been following this like everybody else. And it strikes me that the one thing we have seen, both from the US and the British and the EU, is if they've been holding back, or as some might say, colluding with what Israel has been doing in Gaza. When it comes to the West Bank, they've been actually quite critical from the get-go, especially over illegal settler activity. Well, surely these actions against UNRWA in the West Bank, the British ministers must be aware, the American administration must be aware, they're not making any they're not putting pressure on the Israelis to lift these blocks.
Yes, one explanation for that is that maybe they're trying to deal with this sort of, you know, using quiet diplomacy, ha ha ha, look where that's led in the past. So it may genuinely be that they're trying to resolve these problems, you know, without the glare of publicity. It may be that they're simply not aware, or they're too frightened, or that they're trying it but it's not working and they're embarrassed about it. I don't know, but it's a good question to ask, you know, Messrs. Sunak, Cameron, Starmer and Andrew Mitchell, you know, what they're doing about that. Because it will, you know, everyone could refund UNRWA tomorrow morning, but if the Israelis aren't going to give visas for UNRWA staff to go and do the job, then, you know, it doesn't have a desired effect.
Yeah. Chris, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the two reports. There's currently the essentially the United Nations overseen report. I think it's independent of the UN, but that's looking into the allegations that the Israelis made about those 12 workers, I believe.
It's actually independent of UNRWA, Mark. It's
not independent of UNRWA.
It's the highest investigative office in
OIM. I remember Office of
Investigation.
OIS. So we've got the two reports. There's this one, independent of UNRWA. It's essentially a UN investigation. And then there's the investigation report by the former French foreign minister, and her name is, well, I've got it here, Catherine Colonna. That's coming out tomorrow. Now, of course, you haven't seen either reports or investigations. On the first one, do you know if Israel has actually been taking part in that investigation?
Well, no. Israel has taken a very ambiguous attitude towards it. So on the one hand, one hears reports that an OIOS team went to Israel. On the other hand, Israel regularly dismisses both the UN and the report and says that it's not going to cooperate. And mark my word, the reason Israelis are not cooperating is because they don't have the evidence to corroborate their claims against UNRWA. Because if there was any proper evidence, believe me, it would have been on the front page of every newspaper by now. The only newspaper that would take it is the very pro-Zionist New York Times. I think we can draw our own conclusions about that. What I hear from sources in New York, and I've not had briefings from the OIOS itself, is that Israel has produced no evidence at all. And that's one reason why the report is delayed, because they're scratching around for more. But as far as the investigation into the actual 12 that was the basis of the original allegations, apparently there's pretty much no or very thin evidence against them.
And if I might just come in very, very quickly there. I mean, it was on the basis of those claims about the 12 that Britain, the United States and other countries ceased the funding of UNRWA.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point, Mark. So basically, it'd be interesting to ask Mrs. Sunak and Lord Cameron, on what basis did you take away Britain's 23 million to UNRWA and announce that you were abandoning the agency? I'm calling it the dodgy dossier with reference to Tony Blair's intelligence dossier on which he justified, in inverted commas, the invasion and attack against Iraq. And I would like to know from Mr. Cameron and others, on what basis was it a dodgy dossier? Did you really have facts that showed that 12 UNRWA staff members were taking part in this attack? And if so, did you show it to UNRWA? Because in the past, when there have been neutrality issues, when donors have got any credible evidence against any UNRWA staff members, they bring them to UNRWA. And they say, we've got these very disturbing reports that your staff have done this or that. And UNRWA turns around, it used to happen when I was there, and would say, give us some time to investigate. We'll come back transparently and brief you on what we found. And we would. And generally, these issues were resolved to the satisfaction of the donors that had the decency to come forward and bring this evidence. The fact that Britain didn't do that suggests that it really was taking part in a political attack, which was founded, run by the Israeli far right. If Lord Cameron had evidence that UNRWA staff members had taken part in this attack, why, Lord Cameron, did you not go to UNRWA? UNRWA was given no evidence whatsoever, either by the Israelis or by the British government. And yet the British government decided on the basis of what appeared to be a nothing burger that they were going to defund UNRWA. It's an absolute scandal. And by the way, I would like to point the spotlight back on the British government and say, what mechanisms do you have for ring fencing humanitarian decision making from political influence? Because this seems to be a perfect example of where humanitarian decision making was entirely driven by politics, and millions of disadvantaged people in the Middle East have faced serious risks because of it.
This is an extraordinary catalogue. And we, this other report, which we believe is coming out tomorrow, which is looking into the neutrality or otherwise of UNRWA, these are the claims. Now, if we don't know what's in that report, but if, as suspected, it finds that UNRWA is essentially a neutral organization going about its humanitarian work, what extra pressure does that put on the Biden administration, the British government, to renew funding? And if the British government does renew funding to UNRWA, should it be making up for all the money that it stopped giving UNRWA when it made that extraordinary decision?
Well, and beyond the extraordinary decision, can I make clear, British funding for UNRWA has gone from about 75 million in 2018 down to 23 million last year. So that is a reduction in British aid to UNRWA of 75%. And even that was defunded, even that was taken away. So I mean, one basic question to ask Mr. Lord Cameron and Rishi Sunak and Andrew Mitchell is, why not go up to the 2018 level, which was over 75 million? There's that question. But yes, if as expected, this report by the former French foreign minister finds largely that UNRWA has very good frameworks for dealing with neutrality issues, staff training modules online, disciplinary measures, a whole series of what UNRWA calls its neutrality framework, which, by the way, UNRWA, we developed with the donors. So, you know, if there was something that the donors weren't satisfied with, that was because they didn't point it out to UNRWA. I mean, we've been working, the Americans in 2017, GAO, the General Audits Office, came to UNRWA and did a root and branch neutrality audit. And as a result of that, carried on paying $350 million to UNRWA. Britain has also, I mean, UNRWA is the most audited organization in the history of the UN. And all of those audits have taken place in partnership with the donors. So the fact that they turn around and say, oh, there are all these neutrality problems, you know, physician, heal thyself. It is their problem as much as it is UNRWA's problem. And I think what we're going to find is that this Kelowna report very largely gives UNRWA a clean bill of health. It's likely to say, I keep hearing that, you know, what its conclusions are, that, you know, a lot is being done in terms of neutrality frameworks and processes, and that more could be done. Well, I mean, you know, more can always be done. But as to answer your question, it would put humongous pressure on the British government to reverse this disgraceful decision and resume funding to UNRWA immediately, because there are now no more excuses.
I mean, we have also seen today, it's reported in the press that Lisa Nandy, I mentioned her at the beginning, the opposition's international development secretary, is in Washington, and she's called for essentially for funding to be restored, but also for Israel to be held accountable, Israeli leadership, political and military, at the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, etc. But do you think that the opposition could have been playing a much more effective role prior to all of this and putting a great deal more pressure on? I'm old enough to remember when oppositions did do that.
When Keir Starmer did the famous LBC interview and supported the total blockade, which had been proposed by Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, that was an appalling moment for people who'd supported the Labour Party for all of their lives and were looking to their response to Gaza as a litmus test of where people would vote in the upcoming election, local and general. So, you know, that for some was a defining moment in their relationship with the Labour Party. Mm. And I think the Labour Party could do a lot more. When you talk about accountability, there are several categories, if you like. There's the stratospheric stuff that's going on at both the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, which is there to adjudicate disputes between states, but also the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which goes after individuals. So that's where Milosevic and Karadzic and all the Yugoslav dictators and war criminals all got banged up. And so there's an open ICC investigation into the situation in occupied Palestinian territory. And Britain could be far more active and supportive and robust in pushing that through. I mean, they issued an arrest warrant against Putin and his child rights czar, or whatever her title was, very quickly after the invasion of Ukraine. So there are, you know, there's much more work that Britain could do, the Labour Party and others could do, in relation to energising the ICC, which, by the way, has a British prosecutor, Karim Khan, case.
Yes.
So that's one. Those, the ICC and the ICJ, those international courts in The Hague, that's one area of accountability. Then you've got accountability for the killing of UNRWA, the 178 UNRWA staff members, after, as I said, killing of the World Central Kitchen, seven members of their staff. There was all sorts of talk, because three of them were ex-British vets, military veterans. And of course, there was great concern about that. Rishi Sunak was very energized. But why didn't he phone up the Secretary General of the United Nations and offer his condolences? 178 UNRWA staff members. I mean, you know, if 178 members of any other UN agency had been killed, there'd be overwhelming international sympathy and whatever for them. We've not seen that in UNRWA. So I would like to say, I call for Lisa and Andy and, you know, the government itself to push for an independent, comprehensive, transparent investigation into the killings of the 178 staff members. And that should lead, as Philippe Lazzarini said at the Security Council, to accountability. And by accountability, I mean justice. What we saw after the killings of these people, these seven of the World Central Kitchen, was Netanyahu saying, oh, we've dismissed a couple of officers. No! Do you think for the families of those killed, that is accountability? For a member of my family...
Chris, you know, this is it's a bit speculative, I suppose, but you really do get the impression the scope and scale of some of the crimes that have been committed in Gaza, whether it be to UN humanitarian workers and others, whether it to be journalists, whether, of course, to the huge numbers of civilians, you really do get the impression there is going to be some real bite back. There's going to that some of the political leaders in the West must be beginning to feel a bit nervous that a year or two down the line there will be major opportunities to hold them to account and within these international institutions which they all say that they support.
I mean, just to finish the thought on accountability, as well as the UNRWA staff, clearly there must be accountability for the killing of the tens of thousands of women, children, and male. Let's not pretend that all Palestinian men are terrorists. I mean, there are plenty of civilians in Gaza who are male, and all of their deaths, all these deaths need to be investigated. And where there have been violations, criminal violations of international humanitarian law, there must be individual criminal accountability. And, you know, not so I'm talking broadly. And on the question you asked, I think there will be questions asked, there already are, about the complicity of, you know, the Camerons, the Sunaks, the Bidens, the Blinkens, the Mitchells and others in making this decision to defund. Because when the ICJ issued its so-called provisional rulings on the 26th of January, it was very clear that restrictions of international aid are a violation of the Genocide Convention. And indeed, that's why they made them one of their provisional measures. The question then is, to what extent was Britain complicit in restricting international aid by deciding to cut off the funding for UNRWA? And by the way, the court also, one of its provisions was that Israel had to stop the killing. That's very clearly stated in the Genocide Convention and indeed the Rome Statute, which set up the ICC. Well, Britain is giving military support to Israel, as is America, as is Canada, as is Germany. Are the political leaders who took the decision to carry on with military support, which has led to the deaths of over 30,000, 32,000, 33,000 people in Gaza and rising, are they complicit? And if they are complicit, how do we hold them to account? Because when I hear political leaders talk about accountability, again, I think physician heal thyself. You know, they themselves are arguably complicit. And if there is going to be accountability, then they themselves should be held to account. And, you know, I'm very clear about that.
You know, Chris, international law is, of course, one thing. You know, you and I both work for the United Nations. We heard member states talking about the sanctity of international law all of the time. We also heard a great deal of talk about the rules-based international order. And you know, when we hear from Lisa Nandy, this opposition spokesperson, that many in the global south begin to think that Britain and America and European countries are unreliable partners because the rules-based law system seems to apply to some parts of the world, but not to others. Now, how damaging also in the longer run is it to Britain and the US and other countries that essentially in the global south now, arguably, we are seen as being total hypocrites?
I mean, look at the whole spat over the Israeli attack on the Iranian diplomatic property in Damascus and the response to it. Lord Cameron was asked, what would you do if a British diplomatic premises was attacked? And he didn't really have a very good answer. And then he sort of started talking about self-defense and proportionality. And the journalist said, well, you're saying that Iran had the right to self-defense. And talking of proportionality, how proportionate was Israel's self-defense action in Gaza? So, you know, even, you know, within days and as this is going on, the fact that Britain and others have sort of thrown away the international rule book, you know, one set of rules applies to Putin and, you know, Britain's enemies, and another set of rules applies to Israel and Britain's allies. It's already illustrated. And, you know, when, another pariah state, as perceived in this country, violates international law, say commits an act of aggression, on what basis is the UK going to start taking exception to this? Because Gaza has thrown away the rule book. And the likes of Cameron and Sunak have basically tied their own hands behind their back. And I dread to think what international order looks like going forward, because in Gaza, the rule book has been thrown away. But I think Britain has a chance to save itself, because let's see, once there's a ceasefire, what happens? Mr. Netanyahu will become politically dispensable. It's very clear, if you look at opinion polls in Israel, that the Israelis are going to chuck him out. Well, when Serbia chucked out Milosevic and Serbia wants to join the EU, the EU turned around and said, well, hand over Slobo and you can join the EU. And guess what? They handed over Slobo. Well, maybe Netanyahu, who knows? I mean, wheels of international law turn very quickly, but when they turn very slowly. The wheels of international law turn very slowly, but when they turn, they can often turn very quickly. So, it's not over till it's over. So let's see where this accountability question leads.
Thank you, Chris. And one final question. We're seeing, obviously, a big push for Palestine to be given full membership at the United Nations. You mentioned Britain's role after a ceasefire and what could happen. Well, perhaps could Britain not only support that at the United Nations, but also go a step further too and say, welcome Palestine, as we recognise you as a member state of the UN, we recognise you diplomatically, and also we would like you to join the Commonwealth.
I mean, how can you say you believe in a two-state or an any-state solution and then say we're not going to allow Palestine to be a state or to recognise Palestine as a state? I mean, the inconsistency is so glaringly ridiculous. It barely works. How can this possibly be justified? And when, and there will be a ceasefire, and there are moves towards establishing some kind of post-Gaza war order, that would be an ideal opportunity to say to what hopefully will be a moderate government in Israel, heavens knows what that's going to look like, and to say to the Palestinians and all concerned, look, we've got to go back to the drawing board here, and recognition of Palestine as a state, as a full member of the UN, that's an obvious starting point, or at least a milestone along that road. Because, my sort of wildly optimistic hope is that one of the things that happened on the 7th of October is that the mythology that Israel could manage Palestine question and, by imposing a blockade on Gaza, an apartheid system in the West Bank, that mythology's gone. And Israel, one of the reasons I think Israel is so deeply in trauma is not just about the fate of the hostages, it's also this realization that the lie that generations of Israelis have been sold, which is, sort of might is right and we can, we can crush the Palestinians and manage the problem that way. This attack on the 7th of October showed that was complete nonsense. And on the Palestinian side, clearly they don't want to go through this kind of experience again because it has been deeply, deeply traumatic. And maybe a realization will dawn that, those sorts of attacks have got to stop. And Israel has got to be guaranteed some form of security. But in response, Israel will allow the Palestinians to have a state, dignity, prosperity, freedom, justice, that maybe after this terribly traumatic event on both sides, there will be some push, the dynamics will move in the direction of some kind of political solution. And absolutely, a very important part of that would be countries like Britain granting recognition to the state of Palestine. It's an absolute no-brainer.
Thank you, Chris, very much for joining us. And we hope to speak to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Best of luck to all of you. Bye, Omar. Bye, Mark. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Chris.